Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Today on the show, Alvin Eng's New York story and maybe yours. His book is called Our Laundry, Our Town, My Chinese-American Life from Flushing to the Downtown Stage and Beyond. It's his first-generation memoir of growing up in Queens in the turbulent 1970s and what's changed for him and his community since, and will invite calls from listeners who can relate. Also today, has Mayor Adams changed anything about homelessness in his first 7 months? David Brand from City Limits, maybe New York's most laser-focused homelessness reporter, he will take stock and explain the mayor's new plea for more aid from Washington, because, have you heard this? He says thousands of homeless asylum seekers from Latin America have recently moved or been sent here from Arizona and Texas. The sent here part is intriguing in that the mayor suspects the anti-immigrant Republican governors of Arizona and Texas, Abbott and Ducey, are sending asylum seekers here to try to turn New York against them. So we will get David Brand's take on that. And we'll have a call-in at the end of the show on pandemic purchases you regret. Vox has an entertaining article on that. Was it a piece of Peloton equipment when you thought you'd never go outside again? Was it a house in the suburbs, a little harder to get rid of on Craigslist? Was it a cute little stress bunny that's now grown into this big ornery rabbit in your apartment? And on the other side, the things you acquired that you'd never dreamed you'd ever want, but now you're addicted to using. All that's coming up, and we start here. Feminist writer and podcaster Lux Alptraum says it may be time to move from the era of so-called empowerment feminism to something she calls disempowerment feminism as a response to the Supreme Court reversing Roe versus Wade, Joe Manchin and the Republicans killing the universal child care bill in Congress, and other current events. Maybe you saw her New York Times op-ed on that last week. And Lux Alptraum is also a writer meeting this moment in other ways. She recently wrote a guide to abortion resources in a post-Roe America for Wired. She tweets under the handle, Lux, ask me about self-managed abortion. Alptraum, we'll talk about that. She definitely have thoughts about the implications of the Kansas referendum, in which voters in a very Republican state overwhelmingly voted to keep abortion rights protected by the state constitution on Tuesday. And some of you may know her as the author of the 2018 book, Faking It, The Lies Women Tell About Sex and the Truths They Reveal. Lux, thanks a lot for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Can we start on Kansas? Were you surprised at the outcome?
I wouldn't say I was surprised per se. Going into it, I didn't know what to expect. I know that abortion rights are pretty popular, even with Republicans. So I wasn't shocked when it turned out, oh, wow, like almost 60% of voters voted to keep abortion rights. But with a lot of these things, it's not a question of what's popular. It's a question of who is voting, who gets access to the polls, how much voter suppression is doing to keep people out of voting. With this case in particular, the way the ballot initiative was phrased was very confusing. There was a lot of intentionally misleading campaigning, like saying like, oh, vote yes to give Kansans a choice, which to a lot of people is gonna sound like to maintain abortion rights, when actually they mean a choice to get rid of abortion. So, you know, going in, there was just all of that where I was like, feels weighted against it. But then it turned out overwhelmingly for abortion rights. And to me, that just says that people want to have abortion rights. I think the complex thing that makes it a little less optimistic than I would like it to be is that a lot of people are fine with abortion being restricted. Like we saw over the past decade plus, abortion rights were whittled away through the trap laws and nobody cared. And I think for a lot of people, it's like you say waiting periods, you say mandatory counseling. They hear that as you're making abortion safer, not you're making abortion harder to get. But when you say we want to completely eliminate access to abortion, that's a hard line for a lot of people. Like, you can do a lot of things to restrict it, but the minute you say no abortion, people, as we saw in Kansas, will turn out and say, no, we're not okay with this.
So now the issue goes state by state. You tweeted that the news from Kansas gives you hope for Michigan's ballot initiative to enshrine abortion rights in the state's constitution this fall. Why Michigan in particular?
Well, so I'm focused on Michigan in part because State Senator Mallory McMorrow, who many people know from her viral speech that she gave after her opponent slammed her as a quote unquote groomer for supporting trans children, she's a friend of mine. So I'm very invested in her and her work. And I know that she's currently working to flip the Michigan state legislature so that it's blue. And they're also working really hard to get abortion rights codified in the Michigan state constitution. So it's just a state I'm paying attention to, and it's certainly a state that's much more purple than Kansas is. So if Kansas is going to come out for abortion rights, I feel pretty confident that Michigan will this fall as well.
Also, the referendum in Kansas, as you just referenced, was in the negative. It would have removed abortion rights from the state constitution. Is the Michigan one a positive wording, like, do you vote for abortion rights?
Yes, but it's a little bit different because Kansas already had abortion rights enshrined in their constitution. That's why they wanted people to vote to take that away. Whereas right. Michigan doesn't have any protections for abortion. In fact, they have, I think, 1931 era law that restricts abortion, that there's been battles over whether or not that can even be enforced. So they're trying to add abortion protection to their constitution. Because they don't have it, whereas Kansas, surprisingly, already has that, and they'd have to work to take it away if they want to do anything to restrict abortion further than it already is. And I do want to be clear that Kansas abortion access is not great. There's already, like, mandatory waiting periods. If you're a minor, you need parental consent. There's already a lot of things that are restricting abortion access in Kansas. It's just that they cannot take it away fully.
And you've written that there's a difference between abortion rights and abortion access. And it's very clear when you put it that way, because one thing is on paper, the other thing is in reality, with all kinds of limitations that anti-choice people can still put on it. You know, on Michigan, did you see what happened there on Monday? I heard the dramatic NPR report this morning about how multiple court rulings in the same day stopped abortion providers from serving their patients in the middle of the workday, even as patients were in their offices. And then the right got restored, at least for the moment, later in the day Monday, by another court ruling. Here's a clip from that report of a clinic director in the Detroit area, Audrey Lance, on that first shocking moment.
We wanted to do our very best to take care of them, but that we had to stop for the time being to figure out what we were legally going to be able to do.
Stop for the moment because a court had said that, sorry, clinics, providers, patients, that 1931 law now takes effect because of what the Supreme Court did. And Dr. Lance talks about how that felt.
And felt a total gut punch, and in real time, trying to figure out what this means for the patients that are literally sitting in my clinic.
That from NPR's Morning Edition today and Michigan Public Radio. So that gut punch, that reversal twice within a day, is that emblematic of the state-by-state, court-by-court, literally hour-by-hour struggle that the Supreme Court has unleashed?
Absolutely. I mean, people, you can take the kind of long view, which I do sometimes, and say abortion is really popular, this is going to be worked out. But that doesn't help someone who needs an abortion today. That doesn't help someone whose abortion appointment just got turned over because of what a judge just said. And now they're scrambling to figure out, can I get an abortion in my state? Do I have to travel? This is a medical procedure that's a ticking clock. Because the longer you wait to have an abortion, the more complicated, the more difficult it is, the more you run up against even more laws, the more expensive it often becomes. The sooner you can get an abortion, the easier it is for everyone, really.
And these laws...
Yeah. Go ahead, sorry. Sorry, go ahead. No, sorry.
I was going to say, as these laws get overturned, it just throws people who need urgent medical care into chaos.
Does Kansas make you think the statewide referendum might be a nationally powerful tool for the abortion rights movement, or not so much? I mean, when you look at the polls, Republicans are still very much against abortion rights. Democrats very much for, independents pretty much for. There's been some analysis that Kansas conservatism has a strong libertarian streak, you know, keep your government hands off my guns and my body, where conservatism in states like Texas or Alabama or elsewhere in the Deep South say may not run that way. So I'm curious if you're thinking about the power or not of referenda in light of the Kansas result.
Well, the New York Times actually had a piece this morning that suggested that about 4 out of 5 states would vote for abortion rights if it were put to a referendum. So I don't think it would happen everywhere, but I think a lot of states, even some of the states that we think of as conservative, might be more amenable to abortion rights if it was put to a vote. I think part of the problem is not every state actually has the ability to do a referendum like that. It definitely is kind of how that would work and what that looks like really is built up in individual state laws. So I don't think that that's something that we can put to practice everywhere. But I do think it would turn out more in favor of abortion than people expect. Because, you know, a lot of times we think about like red, blue, but it's much more complicated than that. And there's a lot of people who, I think Dobbs really changed the calculus on this, because there's a lot of people who are happy to vote for anti-abortion politicians so long as they think that abortion is safe. Because it just feels theoretical. It's like, okay, you can say whatever you want, but I'm going to be able to get an abortion when I need it. Right. But now that safety net is gone. And right. So the people who are saying, we want to make sure nobody can have an abortion, even if they have been sexually assaulted, even if they are about to die. When you start hearing that, now you have to take those people seriously. It's not just rhetoric. Like, this is actual stuff that they have the ability to do. And I think that has energized people and people who might have been more Republican leaning. And certainly if you break abortion out as an issue, rather than saying, vote for these candidates who have a package of different platforms that you may agree with some and not agree with others. If you say, like, what do you feel about abortion? I think you're going to see a lot more people say, I want abortion to be protected. Maybe you can put restrictions on it, but I want it to be protected.
So, of course, we'll see how that plays out in the midterm elections, which may be a misnomer for November, because that only refers to Congress. And so much of the action is at the state level, or it's not, quote, a midterm. It'll be the new session of the legislature or of whatever governor is enacted yet. And that, of course, is where the action is because of the Supreme Court ruling on this issue. By the way, Lux, in looking at the polls this morning, I was reminded that there isn't that much of a gender gap that appears to be there about Roe and abortion rights generally. The big divides are by political party and education level, but men and women overall, only about a 5-point difference, 5 points more support among women. What do you make of it, for example, in terms of pinning the anti-abortion movement on misogyny?
I mean, I think it's misogyny is a really complicated topic, right? Like, people will often bring up, like, 53% of white women voted for Trump, right? Which is true. And I mean, that never surprises me, because it's like, we do know there are women in the Republican Party and they're going to be white. So it's going to be a larger share of white women versus women of other races. So when you get to like abortion, I mean, it's really complicated, because there certainly are some women who are like, I could get pregnant and I might not want to be pregnant, therefore abortion rights are really important to me. But there's also other women who are looking at it like, well, I've been a mother and I could never do that, so how could anybody? So I don't think it is as simple as like, well, women love abortion, women want abortion rights. But I do think that you mentioned, you know, misogyny. I mean, there are, as we have seen over and over, there are women who will align with misogynist men because they see that as a way of protecting themselves. Or they think, oh, if I'm really good and I am sexually pure and I do this and I do that, these men will protect me. And like, they say mean things about women, but they mean the other women. And I'm not like that. I mean, we see over and over again women who use misogyny against other women. And so it doesn't really surprise me that we see women who don't support abortion, that we see women who are like, oh, the only people who need abortion are sluts. The only people who need abortion are people who had a bunch of sex outside of marriage. Like, there's this idea, which it should be noted that the majority of people who seek abortion are already parents. And they're often parents who just cannot afford to have another child. So our idea of who gets an abortion is already pretty skewed. But there's a lot of people who have these myths about women in their heads, who have this idea that they are not those women and those women deserve to be punished, whereas they're always going to be fine. But, you know, a lot of times what we see is there's a lot of ostensibly anti-abortion women who suddenly are pro-abortion when it's their uterus. Abortion clinics talk all the time about like seeing the people who protested them showing up in their office the second that they get pregnant. And they're like, well, I'm not like these other people. Like, it's different for me because XYZ, because I already have these kids and I can't afford another, because this, because I didn't mean it. And yeah. So it doesn't surprise me. I wish it did, but it's complicated. Yes.
Listeners, your call is welcome for Lux Alptrom, writer and podcaster on Kansas and other abortion referendum states, or her New York Times op-ed, Women, the Game is Rigged. It's time we stop playing by the rules. Are you ready, listeners, for a new kind of feminist movement or new kinds of outside the system, women's rights strategies, or anything else relevant to our guest? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer, and we'll get to that Times op-ed from Lux right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with writer and podcaster Lux Alptrom. Maybe you know her 2018 book, or read it, or want to ask her a 4 years later question after having read it, the book Faking It, The Lies Women Tell About Sex and the Truths They Reveal, or maybe you read her New York Times opinion piece just the other day on the limits of empowerment feminism. 212-433-WNYC if you want to talk to Lux Alptrom this morning, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. Lux, can you remind people how that term empowerment feminism is generally used and how you used it?
Yeah. So when I think of empowerment feminism, I think of feminism that is saying, you know, we can empower ourselves through the system. If we are confident, if we work hard, if we understand the rules, we can take power. We can get elected to office. We can launch or get to the head of companies. We can shift the balances of power by showing that we're good enough, fundamentally, like by believing ourselves. And there's a lot of you know, rhetoric that goes with it, where it's like, carry yourself with the confidence of a mediocre white man, which suggests that it's just women not being confident enough. Or, you know, power posing, and that's going to make you really feel like you can take on the day. Or Lean In is a great example of this, where it's like, I'm going to tell you how the system works so that you can work for it, make it work for you. And I don't want to say that it never gets results, because it certainly gets results, and it gets results for some people. But I think that it has limited efficacy. And I think right now, especially, we're seeing that it's like, if the system is rigged against you, it doesn't matter how much confidence you have. Like, if people say, like, we don't want to do shows that are led by women, it doesn't matter if you say, like, well, I have all these statistics showing that these shows get a huge audience and make a lot of money. People are just going to say, like, we don't care. We just don't want that. And I think that that can be really frustrating for people who are like, but I'm working hard and the truth is on my side and XYZ. But that's kind of the fundamental problem with empowerment and feminism, that it only works in a good faith system.
And you acknowledge progress toward getting more women in positions of real power, like as CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, a quarter of members of Congress, and a third of all state legislators, even though that's still far from the 51% that would be proportional, plus the Me Too movement bringing down powerful abusers like Harvey Weinstein. And yet you conclude empowerment feminism hasn't delivered on its promises. So what promises are you thinking of?
I mean, mean, I think that many of us would think, oh, wow, we have a Supreme Court that's near, that's almost a gender parity, right? Like, if that's the case, if our country has reached that, then surely we are a country where abortion rights are going to be protected. Surely we are a country that's going to have guaranteed family leave, guaranteed childcare. Surely we are not going to have a wage gap that's that breaks down along gender and racial lines. Like, surely we're going to be in a place where women are not doing the majority of the housework. Surely we are going to be in a place where sexual assault survivors feel respected and feel like their cases are taken seriously, like they have an easy time being believed and getting access to the support that they need. Like, surely all of these feminist issues that women have been rallying, and women and other feminists have been rallying behind for decades, surely we would have made some progress, or would have completed the progress on them. And the case is, it's a lot more complicated than that. Misogyny is still really, really rooted in our politics and in our culture. As we noted earlier, there are a lot of women who still align with misogyny and misogynist goals, including one who is on the Supreme Court. And it just feels like, it feels very Sisyphean, like we almost make it and then we get pushed back down the hill. And I really don't want to undermine the achievements of the people who've worked to make it so that we have so many women in government, the people like Emily's List and Emerge and all of these groups that are working to help put women in positions of power. But I think we also have to recognize that in the short term, that is not working for a lot of people. And a lot of people cannot wait for justice and cannot wait for the services they need. And we need to get creative about how we're going to, for instance, get people access to abortions, how we're going to get,
No, go ahead, finish your thought, I'm sorry.
No, I was gonna say how we're gonna get rape survivors some semblance of what feels like justice, or at least a path towards healing. And like, those are my two issues that I focus on a lot, but I think it's applicable for a lot of issues that are aligned with feminism. Where,
so maybe you say strategically, it's time to turn to a feminism of disempowerment. So
exactly.
Explain how you mean disempowerment.
So it's not about accepting, it's not about being disempowered or not fighting back. It's a play on empowerment feminism. And I got the term from Emma Sulkowitz, who many people know from her art project, Carry That Weight Mattress Performance, when she was a Columbia student who accused one of her classmates of sexually assaulting her. It was not a case that was taken seriously. She didn't feel like she had gotten justice. And she went around carrying a mattress, like the mattress she had been assaulted on, throughout the rest of her senior year. And I connected with her when I was working on my book. And I was working on the conclusion, which talks about, you know, where do we go from here? Talks about, you know, why do people assume that women are lying about rape? And I thought she was going to just kind of do the stump speech of, we have to believe women, we have to believe survivors, we have to do this. And she really surprised me by saying, you know, I, at this point, don't feel like I necessarily need the masses to believe me, because she had tried to be believed and she had just been ridiculed and harassed. And, you know, if you're a rape survivor, that doesn't change the fact that you were raped. People telling you it didn't happen doesn't mean it didn't happen. So she, in her artwork, had kind of moved on to a process of almost pushing back on this reality that nobody was going to believe her by trying to make herself as unbelievable as possible. In that case, she did her follow-up art project was her recreating her sexual assault on video and then posting it online, because that was the thing no quote unquote real rape survivor would ever do. And she was sort of challenging this idea of like, what is a real rape survivor? What does that mean? How do they act? And she phrased this to me as like feminism of disempowerment, where you kind of accept that you are fundamentally disempowered by the system. And then you figure out, well, what power is there in that? Because if the system is not going to respect you, why do you have to respect the system? Why do you have to play by the rules? Why do you have to stay within the path that's been laid out for you? And that, for me, was just really, really powerful reframing And it was something, it kind of gave me a name for behaviors I had already been witnessing. Because you see, not just in feminism, but through so many social movements, people get to a point where they say, we have asked nicely, we have done all of the things we're supposed to do, and we haven't been rewarded with equal rights. We've actually been punished. We have just angered the system, or they have found reasons to deny us even further. And those people often are like, okay, we got to get creative. This path that's not being that's been laid out for us isn't working. I mean, I think sexual assault is one area that really comes to mind for me, because survivors get told, you know, you go to the hospital, you report to the police, you get a jury, and like, if you were quote unquote really raped, then you will get justice. But we see time and again that really the system is set up to stymie survivors. And I should note, I work as a volunteer rape crisis and domestic violence counselor. So I have actually been in the emergency department with a survivor when they were getting a rape kit exam done. So I know exactly what that process is like, and it sucks. That's part of why we have advocates there to make it easier. But you see, it's like you go through this and the kit's not quote unquote proving that you were raped. It's just collecting physical evidence that can maybe confirm what you're already saying, but it can't provide proof of consent. It can just provide proof that there was sex and potentially injury. And then, you know, oftentimes people go to the cops, and even if they've done everything quote unquote right, the cops don't believe them, or for whatever reason, they can't get a trial, or they get a trial and the judge or the jury decides that they're not going to find in their favor. And it really feels like the system is set up not to make things easier for survivors, but to thwart them at every turn. And for me, as someone who cares deeply about rape and abuse survivors, I just think it's madness and it's unfair, and survivors deserve something better. And that something better maybe looks a little more creative, maybe doesn't look like going through the criminal justice system, maybe isn't about worrying about the rape kit backlog. Maybe it's about asking survivors what they need and starting from there.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, my guest is writer and podcaster Lux Alptrom. We're talking about the implications of the referendum on abortion rights in Kansas this week. We're talking about her op-ed in the New York Times the other day that contrasts so-called empowerment feminism to something she calls disempowerment feminism, which she was just laying out. She tweets under the handle Lux, ask me about self-managed abortion, Alptrom, which we will get to. But let's talk to Allie in Ridgewood, who I think is into your stuff. Allie, you're on WNYC with Lux. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Can hear you.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Hi. I called like a couple months ago when you were also talking about abortion and asked a question, and I forgot to say long-time listener, second-time caller, so I'm saying it today.
Thank you for taking my call. Thank you.
And yeah, thank you for what you do. And Lux, thank you for what you do. And I just was, when I was asking my question, I wasn't tuned into everything you were saying to the screener, so I maybe missed if you said something about this. But when you were talking about empowerment feminism, which is something I hadn't actually heard of before, I just was curious what you think about how that relates to capitalism, because some of the language you used reminded me of like stuff I've read about, like, you know, girl boss or like being a girl boss, and it's like, but you're still a boss then, and you're still, you know, like participating in systems that oppress other people. And it made me think about, you know, earlier waves of feminism that excluded different types of women who weren't white women or who, you know, weren't cis women from it. And I'm just curious your thoughts about how empowerment feminism relates to capitalism.
Yeah, no. So I think empowerment feminism is fundamentally working within the system, and capitalism is one of the biggest and most entrenched systems we have in America. So it's absolutely part of it. And certainly this, like, the girl boss, the lean in, that's about navigating capitalism as much as it is anything else. And I think that capitalism is not set up to be a fair system. And I think, you know, I said once there was something like, I think AOC had tweeted about The Wing as like a feminist company. And I thought it was funny because I was like, there's no such thing as a feminist company. Like, there are companies that are founded by feminists, certainly. But if your motivation is to be profitable at all costs. And if profit is your priority, then you're going to end up sacrificing your feminist principles or other social justice principles, which we see again and again and again. Because, and we saw that with The Wing. The Wing got lambasted for not living up to its ideals and all of that. And again, it's because if profit is your motivation, you end up compromising on a lot of things that would make what you're doing more equitable, because they're not good for the bottom line.
And yet, what's the alternative? I mean, I think most of the small businesses that are started in the U.S. these days are started by women, or some very large percentage. And is the only route to a real gender fair system to just tear down capitalism and try to build a socialist state? Or what's really the alternative?
I mean, I try not to be hardline, like capitalist, socialist, whatever. I'm for creating systems that work and that give people the need, meet people's needs. I mean, I certainly think some kind of like blended capitalist socialist system appears to have worked out fairly well in places that have tried it. Like, I think, you know, a nominally capitalist system that also has a robust social safety net is certainly a lot better than what we have right now. You know,
and that's really what people like Bernie and AOC are talking about.
Absolutely.
That's the kind of thing. All right. Allie, please be a third time caller. Thank you very, very much for raising that. Carla in Montvale, New Jersey. You're on WNYC with Lux Halbtraum. Hi, Carla.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I've been extremely curious throughout this whole Supreme Court decision, the process, and the media coverage. I hear no mention of the male responsibility in pregnancy. Women don't have control over their bodies now when a pregnancy occurs, but yet the male that impregnated her is scot-free. He has no financial responsibility, no responsibility whatsoever in raising the child. A lot of women, young women, children really, who are becoming pregnant and need an abortion are not able to care for a child, especially if it's a result of an incestuous assault. The child may be special needs. They live in poverty in these rural areas. Where's the education for the mother, the child care? How does this female, particularly the young females, how are they taking care of these babies? You know, the people that say that it's the right to life, it's not the right to life. These people, it's the right to birth. And then once the birth occurs, they're done. They want no responsibility caring for these children that are going to be born. I think that the males need to submit DNA samples. I think there needs to be free DNA tests for women. I think there need to streamline paternity decisions and garnish wages. These babies need to be cared for, and no one's talking about the male responsibility here.
Carla, thank you. You know, this is coming up on the show a lot these days, Lux, and I think about it two ways. On first blush, and obviously we'll get your take. One is, yeah, obviously, if there are going to be forced births in this country, then the men, if they're not already hanging around as responsible fathers, need to be made to do that by the state. On the other hand, even engaging in that conversation in some way legitimizes the idea of forced births. So I wonder what you're thinking about, Carla, and if you see in any of the states, because I know you follow this very closely, state by state, whether you see any such laws requiring responsible fatherhood after birth to be enshrined in law and enforced.
So I think this is really tricky, and I get why it sounds good to say, like, oh, we need to force people who impregnated people to be parents. But I mean, imagine that you're sexually assaulted and now somebody says your rapist has to be in your child's life. Like, even if you want to carry that child to term, I think most people who are rape survivors are not necessarily going to want to be legally connected to their rapist for the next 18 years. I think that the child support system is a lot more complicated than a lot of us want to believe. And certainly, you know, the thing is, for a lot of people who want abortions, they just want an abortion, like, regardless of whether or not there is support on the other end, They do not want to go through pregnancy. They do not want to go through labor. They do not want to raise a child. And for some people, certainly, if there was financial support, they might be more interested in carrying to term. But a lot of people don't want to have the baby. So it does, I don't want to say it legitimizes the forced birth thing, but I think it is ignoring the fundamental issue of people who want abortions don't want kids. But then, you know,
What about when you get to that point, right? Because there are a number of states who, for some period of time now, are going to have forced births. And at that point, somebody's got to pay to raise those kids.
Right. And I mean, I think the really telling thing that we see is that the states that are the harshest against abortion are also the states that won't expand Medicaid, that like don't want to do family leave, that don't want to do any kind of child support, child income. I don't think that we need to necessarily make it about the men or the people who get people pregnant. I think that that gets a lot more complicated, but I think certainly we can make it about the state. And if the state has a vested interest in people remaining pregnant, then the state should be giving paid time off. The state should be giving, you know, guaranteed monthly payments and child, not even just tax credits, but like lump sums of money that say, like, you have a kid, here's $2,000 every month. Like, if you are a state that genuinely believes that people carrying pregnancies to term is good, you should be financially incentivizing those people. You should be giving those people guaranteed childcare. You should be setting up daycares across the state. And we're not seeing that because this is not about wanting children. Because people who are against abortion, first and foremost, just want to punish pregnant people, want to control the bodies of women and other marginalized people. And they're not doing it because they care about babies. And they fundamentally don't care about babies. If they cared about babies, they would probably want gun control so that kids aren't going to school terrified of mass shootings. But it's much darker than that. And that's
protecting children from conception all the way through birth.
Right. I mean, George Carlin has a great line about that. Like, they care about you while you're a fetus, and then when you're 18, they want you to join the military. But other than that, they don't care.
That's a good 1972 reference. Yeah. We're getting a call from Kansas. Let's take it. Angela in Prairie Village, Kansas, after the big news there. You're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling. Hello from New York.
Hello, Brian. I am a four-year resident of Prairie Village in Kansas and Johnson County after moving from Montclair, New Jersey, after being on the East Coast for 19 years. And I am a longtime listener, and I listen to you in Kansas. And
so glad you're still listening out there. Thank you.
Yep, you're welcome. I just wanted to just make a comment just saying that I'm proud to have voted to say no and keep abortion legal in the state of Kansas. And I appreciate all your conversation that you're having on the topic.
And any observation you want to share about why it came out the way it did there, like what we were discussing before about whether Kansas has a particular libertarian streak in its conservatism, you know, keep your government hands off my guns and my body, that different kinds of conservatism, maybe Texas style, Alabama style, may not have. If you have that much perspective on it, do you have a take on why this went the way it did in Kansas?
Not really. After just being here for 4 years, the gun issue would be a concern for me because there are a lot of rural areas and that do have guns out here. So I would be interested to see if that went on to vote, how that would go. I would hope that it would be gun safety issues that could be put into our state laws.
Let me ask it this way. Yeah. Do you know any Republicans out there who voted no on this referendum anyway, voted for the abortion rights position?
I don't, because where we live in Prairie Village is a blue area, and I think a lot of the Catholic churches, there are a lot of signs for vote yes, but I think that the majority of Johnson County is a blue area. And I think I don't know anyone personally that whether is a Republican that voted no.
So there's a little lesson for provincial. For provincial people from New York City or from Montclair, yes, you can move to Kansas and still live in a blue neighborhood.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
Angela, thank you so much. I'm really thrilled that you're still listening out there. Please call us again. And we're almost out of time with writer and podcaster Lux Alptrom. I did want to reference that your Twitter handle is Lux, ask me about self-managed abortion, Alptrom. Okay, would you tell us something we should know about self-managed abortion?
Absolutely. So a lot of people, when they hear self-managed abortion, they think like people drinking bleach, people using coat hangers unsafely. They assume that this means something dangerous and unsafe, but that is not true anymore. We now have two different pill regimens that are known to be incredibly safe and incredibly effective, especially when you're doing it in the first trimester. And that is a mifepristone misoprostol combo or just misoprostol alone. The regimen for mifepristone misoprostol is one mifepristone pill, and then about 24 hours later, you dissolve four misoprostol pills underneath your tongue. It takes about 30 minutes. And then that induces an abortion. It's basically inducing a miscarriage. If you only have access to misoprostol, you need 12 pills and you do four every 3 hours. And so again, it's four pills dissolved under the tongue, wait 3 hours, do it again, wait 3 hours, do it again. And it's 30 minutes to dissolve. And these pills, the best way to find out where to get these pills is to go to plancpills.org. They link to a variety of telemedicine providers. They link to a variety of online pharmacies that have been vetted and verified and will get you the pills that you need to terminate an abortion. And if you are in a state where abortion is still legal and safe, this is a good option because clinics are getting flooded with people from out of state. And if you are in a state where abortion is restricted, this is still a good option because there's a lot of places that will send you pills regardless of what your state says about abortion, and will make sure that you are able to get the abortion that you need from the safety and comfort of your own home without having to travel, without having to be berated by people giving you false information about abortion, without being forced to wait for multiple days due to a mandated waiting period after you have mandated counseling. I think self-managed abortion is a critical way for all people who are pregnant and don't want to be to take their bodily autonomy back into their hands and say, it doesn't matter what you say about the laws, as long as I can get these pills, which you can, even if it's technically illegal, as long as I can get these pills, I can reclaim my body and I can decide when I am pregnant and when I am not pregnant.
I'm glad you told me to ask. And there we leave it with Lux Alptrom, who besides that Twitter feed is the author of the 2018 book, Faking It, The Lies Women Tell About Sex and the Truths They Reveal, and the New York Times guest essay that first ran on Friday, Women, the Game is Rigged. It's Time We Stop Playing by the Rules. Lux, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.